This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Hey, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome. We've come to the end, but many of you actually didn't realize we were in a process, but that's okay, just because you don't know it doesn't mean it's not happening, right? We've had a whole series of events relating to Yom Yerushalayim. We spoke a little bit the other night about Jerusalem in the past. I hope people enjoyed Rachel Korazin's lecture on Jerusalem in Israeli literature. Many of us came together to see Jerusalem in the present and learn a little bit of Torah in the Beer Bazaar and talk about whether the Torah belongs solely in the Beit Midrash or also out in the Shuk. And what we want to do today is a little bit about the future. You know, I don't know if people have noticed the signs around town. The slogan that City Hall chose for the 50th anniversary of Yom Yerushalayim is Yerushalayim Meuchedet Meachedet, right? That the unified Jerusalem unifies. And my experience here is that Pardes, that which unifies us is not so much the answers as it is the question. Right? We have chosen as a central value for our institution to put the question at the center and thus allow for a broad range of answers and hopefully a lively discussion. That's what we want to do here at the end of this programming. And I'm excited and really honored to introduce to you guys three panelists who've come together to give us a taste of their vision of what Yerushalayim could be. So without further ado, I'll introduce the panelists, and then we're going to start not necessarily in the order that I'm introducing them, but I first want to introduce Betty Hirschman, who is the Director of International Relations and Advocacy at Iramim, Israel's largest standing NGO focused exclusively on Jerusalem's role in the conflict. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I'd also like to introduce Rabbi Aaron Leibowitz, City Councilman, head of the Yerushalmi Party, founder of Hashgacha Pratit, a grassroots alternative kashrut organization here in Jerusalem, and a longtime community rabbi in Nachlaot. And thank you for joining us. And I'd also like to introduce Rabbi Jeremy Gimpel, activist, founder of the Land of Israel Network, and founder of Chabad Arugot Organic Farm in Judea. Thank you for joining us. So, I just want to start off with an invitation. You said, can you go first? You okay with that? I would like to start off, each panelist just take, I'll give you 5 minutes and then a 2 minute warning, so 7 minutes. Please to speak out a little bit of your vision of what Jerusalem could be. And I'd appreciate it if you, within that, could identify something within the present situation in Jerusalem that you feel is preventing that vision from coming to fruition. Is that a clear question? That's what we're going to do. And then after everyone speaks, I'm going to give an opportunity to each panelist to respond to something that one of the other panelists has said. And then we're going to open it up to your questions. So please, I know everyone's eating, and sometimes it's hard to do two things at once. But people have taken their time out of the middle of a very important day for many people, and so I appreciate if we could give our full attention. So without further ado, please.
Shalom, everybody. Chag Sameach. I'm just coming from a tefillah in a Yom Yerushalayim tefillah in Beit HaRav Kook. Okay? The house where Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kook, who was the first chief rabbi of Israel, actually in pre-state Israel, in the British Mandatory Israel, but Rav Kook provided a vision for what today has developed into religious Zionism. And part of what I'm going to claim is that religious Zionism grabbed on only to really a very small part of Rav Kook's vision, and that Rav Kook's vision goes far beyond anything we've touched on so far. And I feel like the horizons that we have to be looking towards are above and beyond the horizons that are usually associated with Yom Yerushalayim. But in order to present the vision which I hold for Yerushalayim, I have to go to the individual who is classically most associated with this city. And who might that be? Which individual is associated directly and individually with the city of Yerushalayim? What? David, King David, David HaMelech. An amazing thing about David HaMelech, which you have to recall, is that David HaMelech faces a people who classically are always split. Okay, everyone knows about the Jew on the desert island who builds two shuls, the one he prays at and the one he doesn't go to, right? And those of you who've been learning Talmud all year know that the primary tome of the foundations of our religion is a book of arguments. Jews are passionate about truth, as you'll see in this panel, and because of that, don't give in easily when they feel like something is wrong. We don't give in easily, and yet King David, in creating Malchut, is challenged to bring all of the people together. Now, the interesting thing is that the Jewish people have a tribal identity, and in that tribal identity, there are two primary archetypes of kingship. One is the tribe of Joseph, or the two tribes of Joseph, and the other is David. This defines the commonwealth through most of the Tanakh, that split. And during the time of Shaul and the time of David, we have a challenge to keep it together. Now, note what happens when Shaul dies. When Shaul dies, by the way, King David, those of you who know Tanakh, and if you haven't, it's a great book. Don't just watch the movie, okay? Read the book. Even just read it in English so you know the stories. King David is anointed as king long before Shaul dies and refuses to touch a hair on Shaul, the king from the tribe of Benjamin's head, despite the fact that he's on the run for his life. When Shaul dies, David becomes king, but not over all of Israel. He becomes king over the tribe of Yehudah, the tribe of Judah, in what city? In the city of Hebron. Okay? And only a few chapters later, after the entire nation witnessed David's pained mourning over the death of Shaul and the death of Yonatan and the death of their descendants, are they convinced that this is not someone with a Judean agenda, but this is someone with an Am Yisrael agenda. And then they come to him in Hebron and they say, please be our king. It says, Ziknei Kol Yisrael. It might even be the first time in the Nevi'im that the words Kol Yisrael appears. Okay, all of Israel, they come and they request that David be their king. And then David says to them, okay, let's go to Yerushalayim. Okay. In that respect, the vision of Malchut that's presented to us in the Tanakh is a Malchut which does not assert itself, but a Malchut which offers itself. And a Malchut which only goes into action when it's invited, when it's received openly. In that respect, modern politics, and I'm sharing this as a city council member, modern politics runs counter to the most basic qualities which are necessary for a Malchut. By the way the Rambam formulates it, as opposed to Chabad, is not we want Mashiach now, but af al pi sheyitmamea im kol ze achakelo, and if it tarries, I will wait for it. And I think that the Rambam says such out of an awareness that Malchut, right, there used to be a wine commercial in California, we will serve no wine before its time, Orson Welles. I don't know if anyone remembers it, but I would say that that's the message of Malchut. You will serve no wine before its time. If it's not invited, if it's not received, then it can't come and honestly claim to have everybody's interest in mind. Now, in modern day Yerushalayim, there is a huge issue with one third of the residents of Jerusalem in East Jerusalem. But you should know that that is not the day-to-day of city council. Okay? The day-to-day of city council is a broken Am Yisrael. Okay? The biggest tensions in city council are between Haredim and Chilonim. By the way, why is East Jerusalem not the primary issue in city council? Because they're not represented, because they choose not to vote. Which, by the way, I respect. A choice I think it's a mistake, but I respect it. It's for them to determine. But the tension is, the primary tension is the tension within Am Yisrael. And here is the basic, here is the foundational paradox. The foundational paradox is that Jerusalem, by the way, if Hebron comes from the word Chibur, Yerushalayim comes from what word? Shalom, which comes from what word? Shalem. Yerushalayim, the destiny of Yerushalayim is to be a beacon of light, of what it means to transcend boundaries and create unity. This is a city which is meant to bring a vision of a world which is connected with one creator, to walk with the creator of heaven and earth on earth, to invite that in. nothing less than something whole can possibly bring the message of Yerushalayim. Because of that, the nationalistic face which Yom Yerushalayim has taken on runs counter to what Yerushalayim is meant to be. It's not about it being ours. It's about us being in service of a universal vision. Okay? But at the same time, just as David said, we are not ready to take the next step. So I will, at this point, I will administer to my tribe who want me as king in Hebron. I think currently Am Yisrael, that's our state. And because of the way this panel is set up, East Jerusalem clearly is meant to be in the center of our conversation. What I would say is that my vision, and today, by the way, I'm going to merit to be in a multi-faith prayer at Mitzvah Tachana. And I'm going to choose not to march with the flags to the Kotel through the Muslim quarter. I'm going to choose to be in the march, in the alternative march, which I invite you to, by the way. It starts at 3:30 near Tzur Bacher, walks through Gonanim, up through Park HaMesila, beautiful music along the way, balloons, families, kids, ending in Mitzvah Tachana with dialogue and listening circles, following by a multi-faith prayer. Nonetheless, I have to say that over here, the invitation to a universal step has to be an invitation which there's really very little you can do than wait for it to be accepted. And here is really the call, the deep call. I mean, I feel like East Jerusalem, they're residents of the city and have equal rights. And we haven't lived up to that, but we're getting better. Okay? That's my one line which you can lay into. We haven't lived up to it, but we're getting better. But ultimately in the equations, I feel like part of this is a holding pattern and first addressing the tensions between us internally. Learning how within Am Yisrael we can bring a message of unity. The next stage will be to anticipate the Arabs and Palestinians in Jerusalem and Israel joining in a quest for something better. What does it look like? I'll quote Rabbi Mike on this. Sometimes when it comes to these things, we suffer from a dearth of imagination. Okay, a tremendous lack of imagination. And because of that, I think this is a redemptive process, which requires out-of-the-box vision, in which Am Yisrael don't own Yerushalayim or Eretz Yisrael. Am Yisrael are owned by Yerushalayim and Eretz Yisrael and are stewards to a process which ultimately must be universal. Can't be national. Must be universal.
Great. Do you all mind if I remain grounded in my seat rather than standing? I'm more of a panelist than a pastoral speaker. You can't see me? Great. Okay, we're getting up then. Okay. What's that? No, I'm good. I'm fine. I want to first thank you very much for including Yeramim here today. Part of my vision for the city is certainly that we will have more dialogues, open dialogues like the one that we're having here today, because as we know, there is certainly a dearth of respectful dialogue going on, not only here in our city, but in the diaspora public as well. A lot of polarities. And so, you know, you have a very unique environment here, and it's a pleasure to be here among you. I am not a native Jerusalemite. I chose Jerusalem. I chose Jerusalem when I made Aliyah at the age of 43. I left my life behind. I left my career behind. I had graduated from an elite leadership program, and I decided to leave it and family and friends behind to come here and make Aliyah. My friends in Tel Aviv who were standing ready to embrace me and who did kind of shrugged their shoulders when I said I was moving to Jerusalem. They didn't expect that. You know, I was a secular, sort of outspoken person, politically, you know, liberal. What are you going there for? It's oppressive, it's backward, why? But I came here for one specific purpose, and that was to, you know, naively work on the conflict, as I called it. In large part, really, because I was struggling with what many people your age do, at least many people, increasing numbers of young people in America. And though I clearly no longer qualify demographically to be a millennial, It's that struggle to reconcile my American Jewish democratic values with what's happening here on the ground in Israel today. And I think for me, for my generation, a little bit more painful, actually, because I grew up so close to 67 at a time when, you know, Yasser Arafat wasn't considered a negotiator. He was blowing up buses of school children my age. That's what I watched. But I also watched Anwar Sadat come. You know, I remember being in religious school, and they rolled out the TV, and we watched what happened on the lawn of the White House. That was also part of my consciousness growing up. But still, you know, came from an environment of irrefutable, undeniable, unambivalent support for Israel. And that still factors in. That's still a tension for me in terms of my identity and what I bring to this. But there was no lack of clarity for me in choosing Jerusalem and in choosing Yerushalayim, whose mission is to create the conditions for a more viable and equitable and sustainable Jerusalem, both now, today, and toward an agreed political resolution of the conflict. That was my vision in coming here to Jerusalem, and I ran out of savings, and I did degrading jobs that I never could have anticipated, like shoveling cat crap out of, you know, cages at a local shelter, because my vision was that strong. I wanted to be here. Because if Jerusalem is the center of the conflict, then Jerusalem also has to be the place from which solutions for the future, solutions to solve the conflict, come from. You know, it occurred to me, though, I had a realization a couple of years ago at an alternative Jerusalem Day event that we put on every year at Yerushalayim. There was a panelist of speakers. One was a policy analyst from the S. Daniel Abraham Middle East Center for Peace in Israeli, and the other was a Palestinian professor from Al-Quds, an architect. And the Israeli started out by talking about his vision of what the future would look like under a two-state solution, talking about sort of like a soft division of the city using landscaping and other soft barriers to create that line. And the Palestinian professor said, no, there's no way to start from that point of physical separation, because by doing that, we would only replicate the political and social and economic divisions that create the rifts in the city today. And then he proceeded to show pictures of what his vision of a city would look like. And it was an open city in which there was thriving culture, in which there was open commerce, in which there was free flow across, free access and flow across the city. And I realized right then that what I was talking about, vision in coming here, wasn't vision so much as mission, right? It was my mission. It's the mission of my organization to create these conditions for a more viable city and to fight for an agreed-upon political resolution. But I realized that at no time had I really ever had a true vision, like in my visual imagination, of what the city would look like. I mean, how many of you have a sense of what the city would look like? I just kind of want to know if I was the only one who sort of lacks that. Okay, because how can we possibly aspire, right, to have a future in Jerusalem if we don't know what that looks like, okay? So that was a stunning revelation in my own work. So just, okay, got the two-minute warning. So let's talk about what that vision looks like as inspired by that evening. I have a vision of one Jerusalem with two capitals, West Jerusalem as the capital for Israel and East Jerusalem or Al-Quds for the future Palestinian state, under a two-state solution, with the two nations living side by side, with open access and respect for all of our holy sites and maintenance of the status quo, which respects the primacy of Muslims at the Haram al-Sharif to pray and Jews at the Western Wall. It's a city in which there are trees and playgrounds and classrooms for the children of for East Jerusalem. Right now, there is a dearth of over 2,600 classrooms. Doesn't bode well for the future of our city. It's a city in which these children will be able to grow up and attend university with their Israeli peers at the Hebrew University, which now they can take their matriculation exams in East Jerusalem and be able to do that. That is a step forward. It is a vision in which there are paved sidewalks in East Jerusalem so that mothers holding the hands of their wee children don't have to walk in the middle of traffic at midday or when they're picking their kids up from school. It's a city in which, a vision in which there are job opportunities because the city's commercial center is more integrated and we have authorities from East and West Jerusalem that are working on joint products, projects and have shared authority for managing utilities and working on other natural points of coordination in the city. It's a vision where Palestinian homes are not demolished. There were over 120 Palestinian homes demolished last year, and that won't happen because there will be equitable planning rights across East and West Jerusalem. I picture a place where Jewish and Palestinian kids are playing in the parks together and having vibrant and spirited conversations at university, both about their future and with shared respect for our past histories. And when the city, though divided into two nations, is no longer unified by angst and fear for our children, but by a vision of promise and opportunity.
So my name is Jeremy Gimpel. Just a little bit about me. I mean, I moved to Israel when I was a young boy. I'm building an organic, self-sustained, off-the-grid farm in the mountains of Judea, pretty much in one of the most contested areas in the West Bank. It's not like on the inside of the prepared wall, it's specifically on the outside of what would be the two-state solution. And it's Judea, and we, of course, are in the mountains of Judea now. And for me, where I am, I agreed with almost everything that she said. Everything that she said, I wholeheartedly agreed with. Except for the two-state part, and except for the status quo part. Now why? Anna atakalam al arabiya alilan. Do you speak Arabic?
I don't.
I didn't think so. I do. Because I live amongst my cousins. Because I'm making friendships in relationships. If we think that this problem is going to be solved by some politics in signed papers by politicians who, I think Mahmoud Abbas today is a billionaire, by the foreign funds that he's pocketed himself, and just ask the Arabs if they feel represented by him or not, this solution will be solved by people, living with people, working together, talking together. So I chose to live specifically amongst my Arab cousins to find out that actually we're not so different. We both really believe in one God. We believe in a morality. We believe this land is even holy. But what I don't believe in, I just came back 2 hours ago from Har HaBayit. What did you call Har HaBayit? Because you specifically didn't say Har HaBayit.
Temple Mount, Haram al-Sharif.
Because
Haram al-Sharif to Muslims.
Right. So she said she wants to keep the status quo of Haram al-Sharif, where the Jews can pray at the Western Wall. Because I want you, I went up there for the first time with my little kids, 13 years old and 10 years old. We went up to Har HaBayit for the first time. And we had 30 police officers and about 15 Arab from the Waqf watching over us to make sure we wouldn't open our mouths and pray. Because the one place in Jerusalem we've actually relinquished control to the Muslims, where Jews have no authority, where we've said, we've given it over now to the Muslims, let them do what they do. And you know what they've done? They've done the same that they've done in Syria to the Christians, in Iraq to the Yazidi. And I heard the time, Iramim solely focused on Jerusalem's role in the conflict, political resolution of the conflict, Jerusalem is the center of the conflict. Come on, that's like 1990s talk. I think we finally realize the center of the conflict is not the Jews, and the ikar of the conflict is not in Israel. There's a global phenomenon that's happening all over this region, and we're sort of stuck in the middle of it, and somehow like the Jewish guilt inside us wants to blame ourselves for jihad in Manchester, and jihad in London, and jihad in Brussels. But there's a much bigger problem going on with the Arab culture around us. And for sure, it's not going to be solved with more politics. Because their movement is a religious movement. And if there's any chance of any progress, maybe what Rav Fruman, Zichrono Livracha, was doing outside Tekoa next to my farm, entering into dialogue, a religious dialogue with very religious people, entering into relationships individually with people. I don't feel like the land of Israel belongs to the Jews. I feel like Jews belong to the land of Israel. We're not called Jews because of the tribe of Judah. The first time in the Tanakh anyone is called a Jew is Mordechai, HaYehudi, Mordechai the Jew. But he's Ish Yemini from the tribe of Benjamin. So why is he called a Jew? Why are we called Jews? In the Tanakh, we're called Hebrews. We're called Israelites. Where did the word Jew come from? Why is Mordechai called Mordechai HaYehudi? He's called a Yehudi. Jews, our identity. We are Jews because we're from Judea. This is our mountain. These are our mountains. This is where we were born, as our identity as Jews, wherever we live. And if we lose now our own claim to our own place, you know, they just asked Ahmed Tibi, a member of Knesset from the Arab Party, tell me, UNESCO just passed this resolution saying the Jews have no historical connection to Jerusalem. Do you really believe that? He looked the reporter right in the eye and said, that's my narrative. I don't feel obligated to respect that narrative that doesn't respect mine. I don't feel a need to accept everyone's reality when I'm being persecuted. When my children, but just because it burst from their heart, they just started davening to Hashem. And a waqf man came up to my 10-year-old and just stomped up it! And my kid was like, oh, Papa, what happened? Are you kidding me? That's the status quo we want to keep in Yerushalayim, Yer HaKodesh, so the Jews can daven at the wall at the bottom. Or the Arabs, they can have the Temple Mount. But the holiest site for us is not the Kotel. It's not. The Kotel was a retaining wall to Har HaBayit. And Jews can't pray? I mean, isn't the cornerstone of democracy freedom of religion? But the status quo is so holy that the Jews can't have freedom of religion in our own Jewish democracy? How far backwards do we have to bend until we prove to ourselves, you know what, we're really a moral people. We're really a good people. There's jihad. They're trying to kill us. Come on. The vision of Yerushalayim is laid out for us thousands of years ago by Yeshayahu HaNavi in the second chapter, in the 56th chapter, again in Micha in the fourth chapter. And it's such a beautiful vision. Beiti Beit Tfilai Kare L'Kol HaAmin. That Har HaBayit will be a place, the center of Yerushalayim, where everyone from every background can go and pray. Muslims aren't stopped at the Kotel. I've invited Buddhists to my home that davened at the Kotel. Why is it that only Muslims are allowed to pray at Har HaBayit? If you're a Christian, you can't bring up a Bible. If you're a Jew, you can't bring up a Tehillim. And we're sanctifying the status quo? Why? It's been 50 years now. I think it's time for the Jews to actually make our claim, saying we are the custodians of this city. We have a responsibility to the nations of the world to actually protect Yerushalayim from jihad, to allow anyone from any background, if they want to pray to God in any way that they want to, come on up and pray alongside us. Once we relinquished control of Yerushalayim, it became apartheid. Not us against them. It took me 3 hours to get up to Har HaBayit today. Standing in line, being frisked, being checked. So, the vision of Yerushalayim is to be one where all people come together. If you're an Arab, you're a Muslim, you're a Jew, you're a Christian, do you love Israel? Do you want to support Israel? You want to serve in the army alongside me? You want to serve in Shirut Lumi? You want to be a participant in building this beautiful society, the only free society in the whole Middle East? Bivakasha! You want to kill us? Bye. Bye. Either you'll go to prison or we'll drop you off in Syria. Let's see your luck over there. It's very simple. You want to join us? Bivakasha. Freedom. Equality. Absolutely. But equality also for the Jews. Equality for everyone. Is that not the vision of Tzelem Elohim? That all of humanity was created in the image of God? We have to stand up for our own rights. We're also created B'Tzelem Elohim. V'magia gam lanu lehitpalel b'Har HaBayit.
Okay, so now I'd like if each of you could take an opportunity to respond to something either specifically that one of the other panelists said, or if you feel like that there's a further point that was spoken to you that you made that you want to flesh out. I think that's our result. Meaning it doesn't have to necessarily be oriented toward one of the others, but if you feel something that you said deserves a greater articulation, now is a good time to do it.
Okay, so I will start. You said something important that I appreciate, which was that Jerusalem is not ours, but we are in service, universal service to the city. I appreciate that. You also used the term equal rights between, I guess, Israelis and Palestinians in the city. So my question is, you know, we have citizens of Israel living in the west of the city. We have permanent residents living in East Jerusalem. East Jerusalemites, Palestinians, were not given citizenship in 1967 when we annexed Jerusalem. They were given the what was at that point designed to be a temporary status of permanent residency. It's pretty permanent at this point, some 50 years later. It does allow them to vote in municipal elections. Many don't, so as not to legitimize the conflict or the occupation in their eyes. It does not give them the right to run for nor vote in national elections, where all of the critical decisions that impact their daily lives are made. It is conditional. It can be taken away at any time if they go away too long to work or to study. It is not transferable if they marry anybody outside of Jerusalem, including children that might be brought in. They live under, you know, constant fear of having their residency revoked. There have been close to 5,000 revocations of permanent residency since 67, and when that happens, they lose their attachment to the city. They're displaced. So I could go on about permanent residency, but certainly how can we consider, in addition, planning rights. I mean, the complete suppression of planning rights. We're building all of the time in Gilo, in Har Homa, etc. They can't get one plan that pushed through the planning process. So how can we call that equal rights?
Okay. I'm going to stand up.
Oh, I'm sorry for not standing
up. I'm a rabbi, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, I want to say that if there's any quality which Jerusalem, which I think is built into Jerusalem and which Jerusalem can hold as a model for the world, it's the quality of brokenheartedness. Okay? You know, when I look at the Kotel and imagine that the Kotel has become the focal point of our identity, this broken, single piece of a wall and something which if you really connect with that wall, then I think that the holiness radiates from it. But I also think I think you can hear the wall crying. And I feel like that brokenness, a place, and that's the first thing I want to say. I want to say to both of you. It's so messy. Okay? In other words, if you come out of this panel confused, then I would invite you to translate that confusion into a brokenheartedness, and the kind of brokenheartedness, like the Tisha B'Av kind of brokenheartedness, the brokenheartedness that connects us to something which Kohelet says, Tov lalechet el beit ha'avel mi'el beit ha'mishteh. Better to go to a house of mourning where at least you know that the emotions are all real. The bare truth and reality of the emotions are so present. And I think give birth to a tremendous amount of empathy. I think that the picture that you're painting is not 100% accurate. I think it's 60% accurate. I'm not a member of the planning committee, but the times that I've attended the planning committee in lieu of the member of the Yerushalmi party who sits there and represents us, and I'm his kind of memale makom, I'd say at least half of the approvals that are happening in the planning committee are East Jerusalem, are petitions by East Jerusalem residents and projects in East Jerusalem. Now, does that mean that there aren't other projects and residents whose plans are stuck? There are. By the way, there are many residents of West Jerusalem who plan this, but this is a chronic issue. Is it equal? No, it's not equal. And here all I can say, you know, I remember I was one time sitting in the Ministry of Interior waiting online with a friend of mine, and we were waiting online for like an hour. And I was like, I was clutching about it. And my friend said to me, you know, remember when we first came to Israel and you used to have to spend 7 hours in Misrad HaPanim to get your... Anyone here around, like in the 80s, when Misrad HaPanim was like a full day enterprise, right? So now you have to wait online for an hour and a half. And then he said three words which resonate for me till today. Working on it. working on. Because it's messy. It's messy because of the residents of East Jerusalem who are full of animosity to us. But to paint all residents, to paint jihad as if that is the be-all and end-all of the Palestinians and Arabs who live in Israel, not to recognize that the Arab world is going through its own process. Okay? And what can I say? To some extent, we might have to wait till they finish their process in order for us to build the kind of partnership which brings them into city council. I mean, I think, by the way, the most dangerous thing for Israel today would be, and, you know, I've said this to Palestinians that I can talk to, like my good friend Ziad, who runs Magen David Adom volunteers in East Jerusalem, or Ali Abu Awad, who's involved in dialogue with settlers. I say to them, don't you realize the thing which would have Israelis shaking in their shoes would be for a Martin Luther King or a Gandhi to rise up among... Now, there's a certain place... I realize I'm taking a lot of time here, but this is the heart of what I hold. First of all, it's not kumbaya. Okay? Holding a vision of a bigger future means holding the responsibility to be in the trenches over every single discussion, every single argument. When signs, please walk in modest dress in our neighborhood, went up in my neighborhood of Nachlaot, in the Haredi courtyards, and Haredim came to me from the courtyards and said, you have to get them taken down, these are the extremists, they're not us. So I said, so come with me to the mayor. And they said, no, we can't. We're not going to, you know, you have to do it, and just don't say our names, because we've got our own internal issues. So I said to them, I am sorry, when you are ready to take responsibility for your process, then I am here to work with you. And there's a place where that's my primary attitude towards right now the Palestinians and East Jerusalem. I will do what I can under the current circumstances. But it's too messy for me to own your process. There's a certain determination. And by the way, it's disrespectful. It's disrespectful for me to condescend to a community which haven't yet determined whether they want war or peace and make those decisions for them. And presume to be able to... I was in a panel discussion in the Israel Museum 2 days ago. The whole panel discussion was two-state solution, one-state solution. I was like, the Jews are going to decide whether it's a two-state solution or a one-state solution. Right? This is our... So there's a certain... And by the way, we like to believe that we will live to solve this problem. Okay? But let's be prepared... Let's be prepared and humble enough to say that it might take another 400 years, another 500 years. And here, by the way, is one place where I do agree with you, Jeremy. The real work between Chilonim and Datiim and between East Jerusalem and West Jerusalem, the real work is the grassroots. The real work is the community. The place where you can build conversation, and that's what we're doing in Ashkacha Pratit between Datiim and Chilonim and Kashrut. And I also know of a tremendous amount, Yeramim, by the way, are key in a lot of processes, like grassroots processes. There's a tremendous, you can completely bypass all of the other, all the challenges and really get to work on building a society and a city.
Okay. I really love living things. I love them. I was a vegan for about a year and a half, because I just couldn't imagine taking a life of a living creature. But then I like playing sports, so I felt like I really needed the meat. So then I only eat meat from the animal if I know its name. If I know the animal's name, then I feel like it has enough love that I can eat it. But, I mean, I love life. And my vision is to spare life. To spare life. I mean, this political solution. Imagine within the Jewish world, if Pardes signs a document with the Orthodox something, is that going to actually like make egalitarian minions in Lakewood? That's not going to happen. But maybe dialogue between some people in Lakewood and people here, understanding your perspective, understanding their perspective. But it's so 1990s to think that some documents signed by political realities, I mean, the same people that wanted to give the Golan away 10 years ago, we would have ISIS swimming in the Kinneret now. But we have, we signed that document. What about the document? We signed that as if that has anything to do with the reality, as if the Arabs who live around me even know what the 67 borders are in UN Resolution 242. And it's like a totally irrelevant concept to them. What they do want, though, is respect, What they do want is freedoms. But you know what? Sometimes you have to take responsibility for your leadership. Israel totally removed itself from Gaza. They had an opportunity to build Singapore. And what they did was build tunnels and shoot rockets and try to kill us more, because it was never about that border or this border, and it does nothing to do with the 67 borders, and when they're done with the 60, it'll be the 48 armistice lines, and when they're done with that, I mean, come on. They attacked us in 1967. They attacked us in 1967, 50 years ago today, because of the 1967 borders. We didn't have the 1967 borders yet. The PLO was founded in 1964. So in 1964, the Palestinian Liberation Organization was the Nevuah. We're going to leshachrer the 67 borders in 1964. I mean, come on. So this, like, very Western, very American idea. Let's get Trump involved. That'll bring the solution. Let's get Trump involved and get him to negotiate the big deal. I mean, is this La La Land? Is this like reality TV? It's like American. I don't understand it. It's just not going to happen. But what the Jews need to, like, internalize is that, like, we're good. I serve in the IDF. We are a moral, just army. The last time I was in Gaza, we went into a terrorist home, and a chayal next to me called up his rabbi and said, "Rabbi, can I charge my cell phone in the terrorist house? Because it might be gzela that I'm taking his electricity without asking him." Only in the IDF are there such moral soldiers. But Jews love to, like, put on the guilt, like, it's our fault, and it's our fault, and it's our fault. Yes, it would be wonderful for them to have more sidewalks, and it'd be wonderful for them to have better parks. It'd be wonderful for them to serve in the army and pay taxes. And if they want, they can have citizenship. They choose not to have citizenship, because democracy is not a part of the Arab culture. There is no other democracy around here. So they choose permanent residence, because, like, what's the difference of living under this reality or that reality? Like, the democratic process is just not, like, a part of their culture. That's not our fault. Hopefully, we've been situated by divine hashgacha in the darkest region of the world to teach our neighbors that we can be different and still respect each other. That we can be Jews and Christians and Muslims and Baha'i and Buddhists, and we can all recognize Tzelem Elohim in each other. That's why we're here in the Middle East. God didn't put us in Madagascar. He put us right here for a very specific reason. And it's up to us to actually rise up to the occasion. Stop blaming ourselves for their problems. They have problems, and a problem that they're, like, going through a whole thing now, all over the world. Not just in Arabia. In Manchester it's happening, and that boy was born in London. There's, like, a refinement that's going on now. We can't take responsibility for Gaza choosing the Hamas. An 80% victory is landslide. So we gotta, like, don't beat ourselves up all of the time. Enough people are beating us up all of the time. If I'm, like, the right-wing settler living in the most contested area in the West Bank, compare me to, like, the most radical on their side. I'm a vegan. Give me a break. Really? Can we really make that moral equivocation between the settlers and the Hamas? And they have their radicals and the Jews have their radicals. I'm as radical as they come. I'm on Har HaBayit. I'm in the West Bank. I'm building the farm. I'm, like, the right-wing spokesman here. We're really not that bad.
I want to open it up to questions now, and you can either direct your questions specifically to one of the panelists, or you can invite everyone to respond. Adam, what's up?
Hi. I'm kind of confused by your veganism has anything to do with your political views. But you talked about the need to see everyone in Tzelem Elohim, something I think is beautiful, but then you also are equating all of Islam with jihad. So I'm wondering how you kind of make that out in terms of your understanding of seeing everyone to be able to be together and to have Muslims and Jews together, but then equating them all with jihad.
Yeah, very good.
And given your difficulty with that understanding of the world, as many people might have with jihad, how you are willing to say you hang out with your neighbors, but then again, they're proposing jihad. So I'm wondering if you can explain
your absolutely. Understanding. Yeah, it's not fair to say that all Muslims are jihadists. It's not true. But a lot of them are. I know them. They talk to me. A jihadist, you should know, if you remember Daphne Meir, she was from Otniel. She was the one that the Arab came into her house stabbed her in the stomach, and then she held the knife in with the terrorist's hand on her stomach to keep it there in order to save her children, to give enough time for the security forces to come. So she was in a car accident 2 months before, and the Arab saved her life in the car accident. Later, that Arab was a jihadist that was arrested for terrorist activity. So, like, there is, like, a culture that's just so different than ours that you could actually have a conversation with a Muslim that if you ask them, yeah, they want you out of here. This is Dal al-Islam, and we're not supposed to be here, definitely not in an independent country. It is an affront to their religion, period. Jews cannot have sovereignty in this land as an independent, and it's not the settlements, Tel Aviv, one block, independent Jewish reality that's not under Islamic rule. Islam is a political movement as much as it is a religious movement. It's like church and state combined in the worst way possible. And so it's a part of their religion to not allow us to be here. That's just the reality. Now, that doesn't mean that we can't have dialogue with them. Because you know why? The fact that God brought us back here, that was prophesied in the Tanakh, is a language they can understand. It's a language that they respect. If we actually bring a Kadosh Baruch Hu into the conversation, then we can actually have a respectful conversation. I mean, with all due respect to, like, the political realities of the UN resolutions and the Balfour declarations, it just doesn't speak to the common man in Judea, Samaria, or Gaza. It doesn't. So I can recognize that a lot of them have fervent Islamic beliefs, and I can still be their friend. And that's why the veganism is important, because right-wingers are usually projected as kahanis. That's the Arabs as dogs and want to kill them and want to throw them out. No, no, no. That was like one man in one time. That's not at all any of the settlers that I know. I know settlers that are like me, from Efrat, from Neve Daniel. Every single Jew that I know just wants to live in peace, just wants to live with cordial relations with our neighbors. But at the same time, to like not acknowledge that there is an Islamic movement that's violent and militant, and they're crusading throughout the Middle East. I mean, to see the whole conversation here, how many people are dead in Syria? Just like a few miles from here. They're dead. 6 million homeless. Is that because of the 67 borders and the Harabayt and the bad sidewalks? I mean, come on. Something's going on here much larger than Israel. So what do Jews have to do? I believe Jews need to be Jews. And Jews, whether we like it or not, we are seen as the chosen people. By Christians, we're seen as the chosen people. By Muslims, we're seen as the chosen people. Every other page of the Quran talks about Jews. We can't ignore who we are. And politics hiding behind that veil, as if the politicians are going to solve the problem. No. There is no political solution to this conflict. There is no solution to this conflict. This conflict can only be transcended. It has to be a new way of talking, a new way of seeing it. Right wing, left wing. I mean, to me, the left wing are insane.
That's my line.
They want to put walls up and then put the Arabs behind the walls? That's the left wing? The Arabs behind the walls, the two-state solution, they're behind the walls? I don't want to put Arabs behind walls. Then they have to stand at checkpoints. And they have to wait a long time until they get to work. Because obviously their economy is going to be built off us, not themselves.
Mike, this is a panel.
Can I ask that we all have equal time to represent our views? That question wasn't to you. So you want me to take another question, or did you have something you wanted to add?
If she can answer why she wants to put the Arabs behind the walls.
I just want to say, I thought that I had a copier. Was that you? I can swear that that's my line.
I learned that from
that
Ari.
That this conflict... So Ari learned it from me. That the conflict can't be solved.
Okay,
it has to be transcended.
At the same time, I really agree with your realism and that we should feel sorry for ourselves. And complexity, I have data to really think that the Israeli army is particularly moral and ethical. And I also have data from testimonies of things that are not so ethical, because things are, you know, we have beautiful drawings here by someone named Alex, who's a lone soldier who died. His parents read an excerpt from his journal during a domestic violence, where he said, you know, like, I wouldn't talk to the press about our interrogation methods, you know. So there, it's complex, right? So my question, I really appreciated, I think the three of you guys talked about reality. We have knowledge of reality, we're trying to work with reality, and all of us are trying to work with reality from also where we're saying. So my question was about how about, what do you think is possible to advocate for Christians? Do you think to, and I'm serious, like, it belongs to us to blow it up? And feel like, it's a real question, and what are, because I wish it was us, ours, and I wish it was built, but in the meantime, there was history, and then there, you know, so basically, what is the solution?
Your question is, what's a policy for Halabite?
Yeah, because I've heard a lot about Halabite, and I'm asking, what do you advocate, and what do the other families that we
have? Yeah, great.
Okay. You know, how many Americans are there in the room here? Okay, so in America, you know, we're very much, you know, we base our way of thinking, our value system on the idea of egalitarianism, equity, equality, and we have this idea that we should all be able to go up and pray, share time-space arrangements, etc., right? The situation, and you talked about, you know, I don't know if you refer to 67 or the 90s or when it was. There's been a status quo on the Temple Mount Haram al-Sharif, and I'm using that slash mark because to us Jews, it is the Temple Mount. There is another faith, the Muslim faith. Muslim is not the same as Islam. Muslim is a religion. Islam is a culture, art, history, etc. Okay? It's called the Haram al-Sharif. All right? So it is critical and vital to both religions. But since the Ottoman times, and since the Jordanian treaties of the 90s, since 67 with Moshe Dayan, where it was agreed that Jordan would have, you know, management authority over the holy sites, and we Israelis would control the perimeter, there has been a status quo in place that has been reaffirmed again and again and again. And it maintains that Muslims enjoy primacy of religious practice there. We Jews can be visitors, right? But that our space is at the Western Wall. And right now, the situation, whatever you think, it's also halakhically forbidden. I'll leave that maybe to you because that's your forte. Halakhically forbidden for us Jews to ascend the mount and pray, all right? But right now, it's a powder keg. Our city is a powder keg as it is because of the lack of a political resolution. And by the way, felt it was a little bit patronizing to say that because I don't know Arabic, I'm not as well positioned. I would say I live in Jerusalem, do you? This is my city, so I would like for there to be peace to prevail here. By the way, today's flag march that will go from the city center down Agron and through the Muslim quarter. Most of these people are not Jerusalemites. Last year, Jerusalemites said overwhelmingly, we don't want the flag parade to go through our city, through the Muslim quarter. We at Irmim believe in freedom of speech. People want to have a flag parade, have it, but there's no reason to march banging on the door fronts and the shop fronts of the Muslim quarter. There's no reason for Palestinians to be in fear and quarantined in their homes and not be able to conduct business. Why? Why do we have to do that, right? So, but to get back to your question, that is the status quo. It's been maintained, reaffirmed by our prime minister, by many leaders, again and again, because things are volatile enough. If Jerusalem is the center of the conflict, then the historic basin, right, is the epicenter, and the Temple Mount Haram al-Sharif, that's the eye of the storm.
I have a really hard time with the words status quo in relation to Jerusalem. By the way, in the municipality of Jerusalem right now, I'm the head of the opposition. And I would say if there's one deep difference between myself and the mayor near Barkat, it is his waving of the flag of the status quo. If anything, Yerushalayim has to aspire to moving forward. Because Yerushalayim is meant to be a light. Kimitzion teitzei Torah. Okay, from the city of Yerushalayim, there is supposed to be inspiration and instruction for the world, of where we move. Torah means hora'ah, it's pointing the way. So if we sit and we frantically hold on to the status quo, then I don't think we have any idea what this city is meant to be about. I also, by the way, think that it is simply wrong and unethical for Jews to not be allowed to pray on the Temple Mount. I think freedom of worship, especially because the Temple Mount is holy to Jews as well, to me is a basic freedom, is a core freedom. By the way, by the same token, I think the fact that there are many Palestinians in Israel who don't have the right to vote is also a huge issue. And I don't take offense at the word occupation. Even though I do think that we're talking about Eretz Yisrael and we have a right to it, but the fact that there is a huge populace there who have no say and are completely disempowered in terms of impacting their destiny is also a huge issue. All of that being said, do I imagine that when we reach when the world reaches this pinnacle of harmony, which we call Geula, which we call redemption, does that mean that on Har HaBayit there will be a Beit HaMikdash and there will be no expression of Haram al-Sharif? I doubt it. You know why? Because one of our problems is that too many people in this city are living their lives as if they're going to wake up tomorrow morning and a whole segment of the population are going to be gone. Right? And that when everybody realizes, you know, right now we're stuck because everybody hasn't figured out that we've got it all figured out. Okay? I am an Orthodox rabbi, but I don't think that Orthodox Judaism has it all figured out. I don't think it's possible that anyone has it all figured out. By the way, Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, who was David's son, and whose name was that name, Shlemut, Shalom, after he ascended to the throne, he married women from other religions and allowed them to build temples in Yerushalayim. Now, that was a huge fall from grace. But what was he thinking? Might it be that he was thinking that ultimately we're going to have to bring it all together, and that includes the religions of the world? Might he have been thinking that? And might his fall have been because it was premature? Because one thing we know for sure, when King David wanted to build the Beit HaMikdash, he was told no. And I think right now, we're being told no. By reality. By reality. And you know what? When you're told no, when God tells you no, so you say, okay, so I guess my work is somewhere else. And as I said before, I think right now our biggest work is between Jews. And also being a beacon of morality in terms of how we treat the other, the stranger, in this country and this land.
Harabai, yeah, that's exactly what I'd like to talk about. You know, in my neighborhood in Judea, Samaria, and the West Bank, Ir Amim is considered like an enemy of ours. So that's just like the politics of it all. And I think it's this issue that really like brings out why there's such a kind of tension between the settlers in Ir Amim and Ir David and Ir Amim. What is that about? Because we want to help build the sidewalks, and we want the world to be wonderful and it's beautiful. But the status quo in Har HaBayit, that to maintain that, that's immoral. That's unjust. The status quo in Marat HaMachpelah in Hebron, exactly 50 years ago, tomorrow, Rav Goren liberated Hebron. Jews were only allowed to walk up 7 steps. Gandhi remembers a story as a little boy where he's put his foot on the 8th step and an Arab whacked him across the face and he fell down the stairs. And then Gandhi was one of the leaders of the battalions that actually liberated Hebron. Because it was the status quo in 1967, now Jews can only walk up 7 steps. Who made this status quo the barometer of my morality? What's true? What's just? What's good? What's compassion? What is mishpat v'tzedek? Jews aren't asking to make a big hafganah on Har HaBayit. We're just asking to stand on the side and pray to our God peacefully, quietly. But Iramim is saying, no, status quo, we don't want to disrupt things. And here's the real key. Until Jews can't pray, until we can actually pray freely on Har HaBayit, there's never going to be peace in the land. Very practically. It's like a very practical reality. If we do not show our neighbors that this is our city and that we can defend our rights to pray, then they're like, they don't even have the rights to their holiest site. They know it's our holiest site. We have no honor in their eyes. Because we don't even want to pray in our holiest site. They're a very religious people. So we're creating the conflict by not demanding our own rights to pray. And when the Jews say, yes, yes, let's maintain the status quo, it's so holy, the status quo, it's like Kodesh Kodashim. Let's make our barometer Mishpat v'tzedek. What is tzedek? Should Jews be allowed to pray in a democracy? Should we be allowed to like speak our hearts to God? I sure hope so. In Nazi Germany, you can go into the middle of a Catholic church and pray to God. On Har HaBayit, we can't open our mouths like this and pray to God from our hearts. There's actually police officers. One has a camera filming you. And if you pray, 3 Jews got arrested today for saying Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad. They got arrested for praying on Har HaBayit. But let's maintain the status quo because it's holy from 67. Come on.
I think the huge diversity in opinions is representative of some of the issues and problems that we face. And I think it's very complex. I don't think, you know, agree it's going to take us a few hundred years before we get anywhere. But I'm also amazed that we haven't even touched upon some of the issues like equal rights for Arab citizens of Israel, let alone people who have temporary status. What goes on in the Galil? What goes on in the cities where Arabs have been living hundreds of years, and they don't have equal rights like any other citizen? And I think it's very complex. I think it's all going to have to be dealt with. But what I, on the other side of this, when I read an article, front page of the Jerusalem Post a few days ago, it's amazing to me that more people didn't respond, is that Hebrew University, which I consider an institution that was created by Jews in the state of Israel, made a decision that they shouldn't sing Hatikvah at one of the graduations because it might offend the Arab students. To me, that's abrogating any rights that we have to be here at all. And I'm wondering, you know, how you respond to something like that.
Which, can you say your question specifically?
How could Hebrew University, in your opinions, make a decision not to sing Hatikvah at a graduation ceremony?
Maybe ask what someone's speaking
about.
Well, I mean, I'll start out by addressing the first part of your question, which is how could this panel not address, you know, the disparities between Arab and you know, Jewish citizens of Israel and the Galilee, etc. We're here to speak specifically about Jerusalem today. And in Jerusalem, but for a handful of Palestinians in Beit Safafa, who were citizens from 1948, Palestinians aren't citizens. They're permanent residents. So if the disparities between Arab, Israeli, and Israeli citizens is stark as it is, it's worse here in the city. In terms of Hebrew University's decision, you know, I haven't actually read their rationale. And so I don't know if there was, you know, if there could be a way of singing, you know, both Hatikvah and some other, you know, You know, the fact is there's going to be no nationalist Palestinian song sung, and so, you know, it appears that in order to erase that conflict, the idea was not to have a song at all. And it raises the very difficult issues that we struggle with here about, can we have both a Jewish and a democratic society here? It becomes increasingly difficult in a city where near 40% of the population is now Palestinian. And how do we balance, you know, those competing claims to the city in lieu of... I see that there are, you know, increasing rifts in the city, increasing political tensions, and that until we have a political resolution on the city, you know, issues like this are going to represent precisely how tense and volatile things in the city are.
No,
I just spoke. So.
Well, you also deserve the last word in one of these. We keep going in this direction. First of all, I think it's important to project to Jews abroad, and I feel like you to people abroad, not only Jews, to project to people abroad, and I feel like you are best positioned to project this, that Yerushalayim is safe. Yerushalayim is a safe city. My 14-year-old daughter walks home from friends' houses at 2:30 in the morning through Nachlaot, which is Nachlaot is like, you know, the downtown slums, the equivalent of the downtown. I mean, I suppose it's being gentrified, but still, how many American cities can would parents feel comfortable with a 13 or 14-year-old girl walking alone in the middle of the night through the city streets? I mean, it's true that there's political violence here, but there's hardly any violent crime. Hardly any violent street crime. Practically non-existent. So that and it becomes warped because you know, violent crime doesn't make headlines in CNN, but one political stabbing does, and it creates a warped sense of what it means to live in Yerushalayim. I mean, that's not to say that a year and a half ago, when I was sitting down in cafes in downtown Jerusalem, I wasn't like choosing the table with my back to the wall. So there are periods, there are waves which are more problematic. But in general, in Jerusalem is a safe city. But the other thing, which I think is very important, is I feel like North Americans offer a tremendous contribution to Israel and to Jerusalem in our moderate, in our sense of we've absorbed a certain kind of culture, we've absorbed a certain tenor of communication, we've absorbed a certain respect for the other because of our I mean, you know, Jeremy, I'm sorry, I hate to say, but you are like the typical mitnachel. It's true that. You're typical of Neve Daniel, but you know, if we go to Kiryat Arba or Yitzhar, etc., there's something that and in that respect, the connection between Americans and Israelis is very important. The investment of North American Jews in the infrastructure and project, the nonprofit sector. I run a nonprofit, by the way, which is supported significantly by the New York Federation, by the Schusterman Foundation, by the Leashtag Foundation. This, I think, is North American Jewry investing in impacting Jerusalem with a more moderate voice. And that's a huge contribution. To also ask what I can do, eat in Eshkacha Pratit restaurants and tell your friends to eat in Eshkacha Pratit restaurants. But I'm serious, because again, this changing the kind of dialogue around conflict on the ground is changes the picture. And I think, by the way, and I think that when we change it between in the internal issues between Jews, really ultimately we're talking about moderates getting together to fight extremism. And that same dynamic impacts East and West Jerusalem as well.
Okay.
I think it was
This is the final hurrah, yes?
I would like to give each person a last few minutes for closing statement, but let's hear your answers brief and the focus
really brief.
On what can be done.
So what can North American or diaspora Jews do? I have a deep, serious, fundamental arguments with Betty here. But I respect her tremendously. Because what she did was she picked up her life and she moved here. Folks, I want you to know that the American Jewish community at this point is a footnote in the history books. Jewish destiny is happening here. Jewish history has reached a climax here in Yerushalayim. 2,000 years have passed. We're now celebrating 50 years of liberation. I mean, what's happening here is monumental. The real impact of North American Jews is to make Aliyah. Make your impact here. Even if you have views that differ with mine, awesome. Eventually there's going to be some balance that is strict between the right and the left. We're eventually going to figure it out. That's the way Jews work. There's the right and the left, and then eventually we pull as hard as we can, and then we just make it happen. But the more voices, the more Jewish voices, whatever voice you have, voice it here. Whatever you're doing in America, do it here. This is where we need you. I heard that Pardes has a meditation minion downstairs. That's awesome. We need meditation minions here. There's an egalitarian minion here. There's not enough of those here in this city. We need you guys here. You will add more colors to the rainbow. But in all honesty, meaning if we really are proud of being Jews and we want to make our stake and we want to make our mark, this is where Jewish history is unfolding, friends. So don't leave. Just stay for a few more months after Pardes. Just live here for a year. Try it for a year to actually see what it is to live here in this land. And I think that would be the biggest impact possible.
Terrific. We need more diverse voices here in Israel. But most of you are going to go back to America or Europe or wherever you come from. And what I would implore you to do is stop thinking that you don't have a voice, that you don't have a moral or political voice because you don't live here. So I think right now is a really exciting time. I can only speak to America, which is where I come from, in terms of young people mobilizing through all kinds of different forums to challenge Jewish leadership and to challenge the government. I think that in terms of security, security. You know, Irmim is an Israeli NGO, okay? You might, think that we're radical. And by the way, Har Habayit is not our central issue, right? And we believe at Irmim that we need to also have a Jewish dialogue about what this means, that this is not just a polarized political issue, but there needs to be a voice to acknowledge the fact that as Jews, we have historical longing for the Temple Mount, right? But how do we negotiate that in the current context, right? I think the differences are more political, that you don't see that we need a political resolution to this conflict. We do. And boy, we're sort of penned as retrograde these days in places like the diaspora for still clinging tooth and nail to the two-state solution, but we still see it as the most viable of the solutions out there for two countries to live side by side, to both have their respective capitals in the city, and that until we have that solution, we're not going to be able to live safely in this city, in this society, or across Israel. So we invite you to be involved, to come here back and forth, and to not be afraid to speak your mind as well. You shouldn't have a gag, you know, a gag on you because you don't live here. So learn more, talk more. That's what I would invite.
I apologize for the lot of questions in very little time. Is your question to one person or all three?
Two.
Well, because what I want to do is give the panelists an opportunity to actually lay on a more personal level to say. So go for it, Allison. But please, I'm just going to ask you guys to keep brief so each of you can have a panel. We'll do the in reverse order of what we did, the introductions. So, okay.
Thank you all for presenting. It is good to hear such a range of presenters. I think it's pretty clear from I don't remember his name, so sorry, from your statements, how you feel about a Jewish state. And so I'm kind of wondering, and a little bit from you about your two-state solution idea, so I'm more wondering towards you two what, a popular proposal that's coming out more now is like a one-state idea, but not as a Jewish state, but as more of a secular state. I don't know if you would want to respond. Your comments come across to me as very hateful and Islamophobic, and I hope that's a misinterpretation. But to me, that I'm not understanding how that could lead to a peaceful future. So it's mostly for you two.
I'm going to ask the focus of the panel is actually on Jerusalem. So, if you want to reformulate your question, focus on Jerusalem. I don't want to take away the opportunity to ask, but I want
to
stay focused on
it. So, I guess Jerusalem as a capital, could Jerusalem serve as in a capital of a secular one-state solution? Is that a possibility?
And just to give everyone time to respond at the end, please.
Should I go first? Who's first?
You can go ahead while I chew on that.
Yeah. So as far as the politics of it all, I think that probably the person who most closely represents my views is a politician named Moshe Feiglin, who exactly says that the country should have no religious entity in it at all. The Rabbanut should be banned. There should be the very small government, very big land, to maximize people's freedoms. So I really, really agree with that. I know that Islamophobia in the PC American world is a bad word. I'm actually scared of jihad. It's true. I went to Ariana Grande concert and 22 people died. I think it's okay to be scared of them. I don't think that that's necessarily a bad word. I'm just real. I fought against them. I live amongst them. They're a real threat. We're only 6 million Jews and we're surrounded by 1.3 billion Muslims. Imagine if only 10% of them are really, really, really jihadi. That's a lot. That's 100 million? So, focus on Jerusalem. So Jerusalem should be one capital, one place for all people. Maximize freedoms. That should be the goal. Maximize people's freedoms, Jewish freedoms, Muslim freedoms, Christian freedoms, Buddhist freedoms. One city, Beiti Beit Tfilah Ikare Lekol Ha'amim. For my house will be a house of prayer for all nations. It should just be a place where all people can come together from every background and worship as they feel that they want to worship, be who they want to be. It should be a city of freedom and a city of peace.
Yeah, I think you've opened up a question that we could devote an entire another panel to, and it touches on the whole complexity here. We live under the myth that this is the eternal, undivided city, right? And there's no way to really address religious access and freedoms without addressing the question of politically who's going to govern, the entity. So I'm just going to leave it there for now.
I'm going to take 2 minutes just so you know what's coming up. I'd actually like you, if you're willing, to relate to this day on a personal level. I've heard a lot from you on your ideas and also a little bit of personal, but this is a particular day. There's a reason that we're doing another day. I'm not going to confine you to how you want to close your words, so if you choose to close your words another way, that's fine. But one of the things we also value here is you guys as people. You've taken your time and your energy and your passion to share with us. So I'm curious about this particular day and what it means to you. If you choose to use your closing words for other purposes, do you want to just start that process off by closing?
Well, if it's okay with you, I think I can actually combine relating to your question with my closing words.
But I am going to ask you to try to keep 2 minutes each. Everyone has a fair amount of time.
Okay. There's a tremendous gap and distance between how I look at this city and see it in its reality and how my soul sees and relates to this city. This morning I was in the house of Rav Kook, and who speaks of Yerushalayim as the place in which humanity discovers once again that it is all one. And tomorrow evening there is a meeting of city council where I can't even find words which will resonate in the room in a way which they will be respected. Imagine feeling as a city council member that if you say what is in your heart, it will be scoffed at and laughed at. It is so irrelevant. So for me, the tefillot this morning were actually so full of pain within the celebration. But I think I've already given this over, how just Jewish that is. I mean, to be in pain when you're celebrating. I mean, after all, in Hallel, we scream, Ana Hashem Hoshiana. This is when we're singing and dancing. So my answer is one. One. Definitely one. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. One city. But I know that we've got a long way to go until we get to that one, because when I talk about that one, I'm not talking about the same one that Yair Barkat, the right-wing mayor of Yerushalayim, is talking about when he says, a united Jerusalem, and tries to flank Bibi from the right. When I'm talking about one, I'm talking about a different song, a Shir Chadash. Will we be able to hold a unified Jerusalem from now till then? Only if we Jews begin to understand that we have a lot to learn. It's not about everybody coming around to our point of view. It's about some kind of transcendent shift. And if not, it may very well be that we're going to have some creative, on-the-ground solution for this city, which reflects some conversation about the state. Because like I said, I view this as part of a long process. And I can wait, because in the end, it's going to be good. And when I say that word good, I mean it in terms of tov, the biblical word tov. May it be soon.
Yeah,
I've had that.
Yeah. That was, you're actually second.
One second, okay, great, sure. So, just the idea of dividing Jerusalem to me sounds so sad. It sounds so sad. My father, you know, was born here in 1945. And he remembers when there was like a border that cut through the city. And think about putting that barbed wire back and putting up another state. And like, I look at the other Arab states around us. Can we just have one that we wish was like in Jerusalem? Would it be Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Iraq, Iran, Mitzrayim? Which one do we want? And we're like, all right, let's roll the dice and hope that this one's going to be better than Gaza. Like, I just like delusional thinking. The two cities in Jerusalem, like lema. There's a vision that's given to us where we can all live equal. We can do it. And we may have to fight through their own problems and really like bring it to them and say, folks, we can live together. We might have to learn Arabic. And you know, I know that she was very offended about changing the national anthem. Okay, I'm not against changing a flag or an anthem. I'm like, I would be open to that. There's no halachic issue in the anthem. There's no like, whatever we have to do, let's just live together already. But there could be a possibility of like just living together in one city. And if you want to like enter in the democratic process and vote your way in, and okay, let's play that game for a while. If they want to, let them play. If they don't want to and they want to stay residents, I can't force them to vote. But here's what I can do for me. What is today? I have no heartbreak in Yom Yerushalayim at all. Nothing. Nothing. This is the happiest day of the year for me. 6 days. 6 days. Do you know how long it took to win the Hanukkah War? Does anyone know? Hanukkah. Rabim biad me'atim, giborim biad chalashim. We celebrate that until today. The amazing war. How many years? Anyone know? 26 years. We had five armies against us before the 1967 borders. Armies more than double our size. Three times as many jets. Four times as many tanks. Insurmountable odds. We literally lived through our very own Hanukkah. Today is like our own Hanukkah. Bayamim mahem bazman hazeh. We get to have our own Hanukkah in our lifetime, our own renewed holiday. That's awesome. that's only alive here. And so to me, Yom Yerushalayim is like the best. My great-great-great-great-great-grandparents were davening for this day to come. And here now their great-great-grandchildren are dancing the streets in Yerushalayim. Yeah, there's not perfect, and there's a lot to move forward with, and there's a lot of challenges. But higanu abaita, we're back in Yerushalayim again. This is the best day ever.
Okay. I want to start by clarifying the idea of a divided Jerusalem. Jerusalem is already woefully divided. And most, you know, Jews who talk about not wanting to divide the city don't go to Jabal Mukaber, don't go to Ras Al Amud, don't go to Sheikh Jarrah, don't go to Silwan. This is not the Jerusalem we're talking about. So we're talking about a place where 80% of Palestinians are living in poverty. We're not talking about, you know, our vision is that there should be a political division with two capitals where both national groups have the right to realize the city as their capital, but also, you know, a vision of an open city that is not physically divided. Okay, so I want to clarify that when we talk about a divided city. I love Jerusalem. Jerusalem has been my home for a decade. I would never trade it for Tel Aviv. I think it is so much more rich and vibrant. There is nothing weak or bland or tepid about Jerusalem. Nobody on this panel or any of the groups that we represent or the 15 to 50 that aren't lives in Jerusalem and stakes their claim without being passionate about their attachment to Jerusalem. And that can particularly be said for the young people right now, today in Jerusalem, who are not choosing to go to Tel Aviv, but who are staking their claim and working on issues of multicultural pluralism, gender pluralism, education, access for physically challenged people, all of the things that we need to make our city healthier and more sustainable. What we need to do here, though, our vision is to have a place where both national groups and all of the monotheistic religions can live here in peace, and only by doing that, you know, the only way to do that is to negotiate a solution by which both the Palestinian and Israeli people have the right to realize their national aspirations to their homelands. So that's where I would leave that.
Okay, and that's where we're going to leave it. At this point, I really appreciate the fact that there are people who have questions, and there's always more to be said. I want to both personally and on behalf of the party to thank you all for coming, sharing your time, sharing your heart, and sharing your thoughts.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.